What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of The Textual Talk, where I'm your host, HD. Today, we have a special guest for you guys. His name is Mitch Brooks. He is the general partner of High Street Equity Partners. And this is going to be a different episode than I typically do, because typically we talk about careers and regular things and tech and other things that are going on in the tech world. Well, today, Mitch is actually a venture capitalist, and he invests in many different tech companies. And he's also a black man. So I figured that this would be the perfect opportunity to bring him on the platform so you guys can understand what an angel investor is, what a venture capitalist is, and other things that you may not know about Mitch. So sit back and relax and enjoy the episode. I know I said I was going to ask you about the Washington Commanders, but I actually just thought about something. The NBA playoffs is pretty much around the corner. And so I want to know, the Wizards, are they your favorite team, or do you have another team you like?
I'm home team everything.
Sorry for you.
Yeah. Funny, I was at the game last night with my wife, and we went to the Miami Heat game. But you know, the Heat sat their best players. Like, Jimmy didn't play, Haslam didn't play. The Wizards won. It was
good. It's crazy. I'm a basketball fan, but not really. Like, I just always have like one player, and he's almost on his way out the league. So I don't know what team I'm gonna like once Chris Paul actually retires, but I hope he gets.
I gotcha. I like.
Yeah,
Kobe,
I hope
man.
He gets his ring. Crazy thing is, I had a birthday last week, and the funny thing is, way before my birthday, I was gonna go to Phoenix because it's gonna be a home game, and I want to see KD play in Phoenix. Well, you know, he had got hurt for that little stint, and so I didn't know he was going to play. Mm-hmm. So while I was on vacation, I get the notification from ESPN, KD's playing tonight, and it's March 29th. I was like, really, man? I was like, it just wasn't meant to be. I was like, but hopefully they'll run it for my guy, because it seemed like when they got there against, I felt one of two things when it came to them playing the Bucks. I'm not really a conspiracy guy, but I just felt like, why weren't they doubling Giannis and just their, you know, Middleton and everybody else to beat them?
Coaching. That's coaching.
Yeah,
bro.
I don't know, man. I feel like once the sports get to that level, there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on that I can't prove, nor will I try to prove. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate you for joining me today. This is the Textual Talk podcast, and this is a special episode, guys. Typically, you know, we normally talk to people who are doing maybe individual contributor tech roles. Well, in this episode, we actually have an individual who is actually right now currently a venture capitalist. And I thought it'd be nice for my audience to hear him speak, and also maybe one of you guys who are in the audience has something maybe you could pitch to him one day. I don't know. But I thought this would be a good thing, because a lot of us, especially in our black community, probably don't know what a venture capitalist is or what an angel investor is. We probably don't even know what it takes to be one. And so I thought that this would be great for my audience to hear. So in short, Mitch, I want you to introduce yourself to the audience.
So, hello, everyone. Appreciate you all listening and looking forward to like a great conversation and encouraging folks to follow up, man, with me if I can be helpful along your journey. So I'm a fifth generation Washingtonian. I'm a son, a husband, a godfather, a friend, and someone that cares deeply about his community and his culture. I went to school in Florida at Florida A&M, went to work in Chicago, and came back to D.C., where I'm from, and I've been here in D.C. since 2008.
Nice, man. I really grabbed the part where you say you care about your people and the culture, because when we first talked, probably about a month ago, I think, I could sense that in our conversation, and that's why I was like, I knew we had to do this one. So can you tell us about what made you go? And I want to make sure I'm saying it right. So pretty much that's Florida A&M, it was FAMU, correct? Okay.
That's right.
What made you want to choose to go to FAMU?
For me, it was, I grew up in D.C., which is predominantly African-American, and as folks used to call it, Chocolate City. And throughout, I'll say, primary school, I was, for the most part, around my culture and community. And for high school, due to like academic achievement, I went to a high school where I was in the minority. And, you know, Black and brown students were like 5% in the minority at my high school. And just, I wanted to go and have a college experience that was more culturally rich and more like how I grew up. And I appreciated my high school experience for what it was. And it was great. It was remarkable. But for that, I wanted to lean in. And for me, that looked like an HBCU experience. And so it was a matter of like finding the right HBCU where I could focus on business, because I knew going into college that I wanted to like pursue a degree in business. And so in looking at the different HBCUs that had good business programs, I decided for MBA based on their MBA program.
Okay, that's dope. I know for me, I've told the story a million times, but I'm a first like generation college graduate. I'm like on both sides of just going straight from high school and then graduating college. So in my family, there was not a lot of talks about HBCUs. I'm from Shreveport, which for those that are listening, that's from in Louisiana. And I only knew about Southern and Grambling. Those are the only two. I had interactions with both of them while I was in high school. I did some dual enrollment classes. So I said, I don't want to go there because they don't have their business together. And I didn't know any other one, so I just settled on Louisiana Tech because it was the quarter system and it was quick. Grambling is 15 minutes away from Louisiana Tech. So I said, you know, a win is a win for me. So that's why I picked it. But I do think it's like maybe if I go back in time, I would hopefully like my guidance counselor or someone would show me all my other options that I have available that are HBCUs just to go to. You know, a lot of people, that's the one thing, is like the difference is the fact that most of my friends who went to HBCUs like love their experience. They made like lifelong memories. And I think for me, college was cool. I have friends like most of the, of course, at PWIs, most of the Black kids hang out with each other, of course. But I still don't think it's on the same magnitude. But
oh, man, you missed it. Yeah. And, you know, I say you missed it to put a smile on your face and not to, like rub it in for anyone that didn't go. But you know, I want to double down on that and say that that my HBCU experience was some of the most amazing years of my life. And you know, I've had a very fortunate and privileged and blessed life, and those are years that I would love to do back over again. So you know, 4 years of school, and so there's so much that folk gain from, I think, the college experience in general, but in particular, the HBCU experience, man. So I'm a big, big fan of it. Going to a college prep high school, I understood, you know, the paths that I could have chosen in the different directions that folks like looked to encourage me and push me into. But for my kids and, you know, if they have the opportunity to pick what school they go to, I'm going to be the parent that's going to encourage them to go wherever they want to go. And that could be an Ivy, and that could be an HBCU, that could be a state school. Just go where you feel like you'll get the best experience to develop you as a person.
I totally agree with that. So what year was it, I guess, when you left A&M and then you decided, you know, well, not decided, but you graduate and now it's time, you know, for your early career. What time frame was that? And then what did you do in that early career space?
Yeah, I graduated in the spring of 2008, which was a very interesting and trying time. You know, that summer and that fall is when we had the 2008 financial like collapse and bank collapse. I was lucky and fortunate that I finished my schoolwork early, and I was interning already at a Fortune 500 company, and sort of really using that internship to put money in my pocket and just wait to graduate in the spring. And shortly after I graduated, I immediately went to go work for them the weekend after I graduated, sort of transitioning from fall to looking to transition into full time. And to share with you and your listeners, my mom ended up getting diagnosed with cancer, and I learned that over the summer. And so I wanted to just take some time off, and my job was very supportive of it. And I wanted to be closer to her while she was going through her cancer treatment process. And that's when I came back to DC in September. And a lot happened between September and December. You know, that's when everything happened with Wall Street. Barack Obama got elected that November. And so while I was in DC and really focused on family, and I had this job sort of waiting for me to return whenever family was healthy. And I just had a moment in that time and space where I just felt like I should look to stay in DC. And so that's what led me and connected me to this tech space. I ended up going to work for a regional IT firm that's based here in DC. And I had a great ride and journey with them. And so, you know, my background is in tech, more as a business operator, and not as much as a developer or specialist in the space. And so came in as an executive on the business operations side. And it was a great, you know, 11-year journey with them and growing their footprint around the country.
Man, that was a mouthful. I got a lot to say about that, because I've always figured, like, it's funny. I thought about, like, I don't remember if I ever asked you your age, but I've been looking at Mitch. I was like, he's not that much older than me, man. He's not. Because you said you graduated college in 08. I was 16 in 08. Yeah, I was 16 in 08. So the next year when Obama got into office, we actually went to that inauguration, which I'll never go to another inauguration again.
Because it was freezing cold.
Yes, imagine kids from the South. And, you know, it was a historical moment. So the church took, like, the older Black people there. They got lost. Like, it was a whole bunch of stuff going on that definitely we didn't want to. I don't want to deal with that anymore. I just keep it as that. It was crazy.
Yeah.
But it was, it was funny and ironic that, you know, they're trying to make, and I sent this to a guy, and I know you'd be a perfect person to touch on this, and we may even touch on it more later. The rumblings about, oh, the recession, and, you know, it's going to be bad, but people have been pointing out the differences between 08 and now. And I can see how that is, because I know before my time, people were just getting houses very easily. Like, you didn't have to prove anything. That's why that happened. I think past COVID, when everybody said, oh, you know what, we're going to drive the market up, we're going to push rates down and inflate house prices, and a lot of people possibly maybe got some houses they can't afford, or they got houses that went down in value. Now they're trying to raise the rates, and now houses are still kind of going down in price somewhere, but the rates are kind of steady. I don't know. I think I'm in a bubble, because I'm out here in Texas, and everywhere you turn, they're building something. So it's kind of hard to feel like it's a recession when the last 7 years I've been here, it's been nothing but new growth.
Yeah. You all are in somewhat of a bubble, I would say, like Texas and Florida. And it's because folks are leaving a lot of places and coming to where you all are. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of demand for folks to want to come there. But when you think about it, folks are coming there so that they can have a more comfortable lifestyle, right? Instead of paying you know, the cost of living for a home or for childcare and all of these other things is like 60 cents on the dollar in Texas and in Florida in some parts. And so I do think that it's a bubble where you are. I definitely think that I'm seeing it in D.C. and in places that I travel around the country where there's a squeeze and there's a pain that a lot of folks are going through. And I think that it's interesting to some degree that what started in the, I'll say, the pandemic timeframe in the service industry and more in like the blue collar mm-hmm. industry, it has transitioned to more of the white collar industry and, you know, the remote workforce and the folks at tech firms that are like Amazon and Apple and things like that. And so I do think that there'll continue to be a squeeze going into the end of this year. And then, you know, I think as people max out their credit cards and do all of these other things, we're going to start to see how that manifests and what that looked like when it's time to like pay those bills. And so I don't hope and wish that that's the case, but based on all of the data that I'm seeing and like the conversations that I'm having, that's what it looked like it'll be. And so I think you and listeners that are like you, that are in some of the growth areas where other areas of the country contracting, like you're very lucky and fortunate.
Yeah, I definitely would agree. That's the reason why I left my hometown. And like you said, there, it seemed like it's been a recession there for probably 10 years. And I think the result of that happened is, like you say, service industries like my hometown, we were big on like manufacturing, especially when we had the General Motors plant. Once that closed, it's kind of like the dominoes kept on hitting in. It's just, you know, you go there, you can go there for some good food or go to the casinos. But outside of that, there's nothing there. And I know there are a lot of places like that. They're not. I think it is, you know, I'm not a political man far as like just keeping up with every policy in place, but I do know my home state has always been crooked, and I think it's the way it's supposed to be. And a lot of people don't realize that they want stuff to change, but I don't think it ever will change there. But I want to segue. I'm from Louisiana. The Kingfish. What's his name? I forgot what his name was. But I saw these movies and stuff on him. I mean, he was responsible for, I think, getting the roads and stuff like throughout Louisiana and maybe the highway stuff. But outside of that, nah.
Yeah, but Louisiana, they need to do something about the correctional facility they got down there.
Yeah,
that place is absolutely awful, and they should be ashamed of what that is, man.
They aren't. I have friends as like first responders and like a lot of stuff behind the scenes that people don't see that goes on. It's just crazy. It really is.
Yeah.
So earlier I was talking about angel investing and venture capitalists, but before I get there, I want to ask you about, you said you came in on the exec side being in business operations. Can you explain what all goes into that? Because, you know, there are so many different type of operations types of positions that are a part of a company. Like, for example, I work in security operations as well as incident response now, but that's just a subset of like the security portion of our company. It's not the whole thing. But so I would assume that business ops is, you know, encompassing something like I do at my company. It's all over that, like the business operations for the whole company. So could you explain that briefly?
Yeah. I think that my role would be very much in line with what you've described. And so I came in as a director of business development. And the idea is that, you know, we were on the front lines and cultivating relationships with clients and potential clients around the country, looking to like expand the products and services that we offer I'd look into like penetrate existing accounts to get more business at existing accounts. So speaking with the executives and buyers of IT in those different agencies or in those different corporations. And so I consider that to be sort of folks that are on the front end. And then, you know, my personal experience was that I was out there with the CEO of the company, selling the company and closing contracts and deals. And then I would go back and speak with some of those clients and they would say, "Hey, Mitch, you sold me on this thing and this ain't going how you told me it was going to go." Right. And I was like, "Oh." And so I would connect with the project team and the developers. And I'll say, "Hey, you all, like, what's going on?" You know, and they would express to us sort of the gaps or the different challenges that they were experiencing. And I felt strongly like, "Oh, I think the business development team need to know this, and they need to know on the front end that, you know, these are some things they need to talk about and make, you know, the sales team and the clients aware of." And so I grew increasingly passionate about ensuring that the IT developers and programmers could be successful. And I also grew passionate that I felt, you know, my word was my bond when it came to speaking with folks and selling them on things. And so I wanted to be able to look them in their eyes and know that what I was selling them, we could deliver on. And I think as a result of like that interest, the firm over time transitioned me into vice president of operations. And then over time that transitioned me into the chief operating officer at the firm. And you know, I think for folks that are thinking about tech and a career in tech, you know, I think it's important to understand that, you know, there are business folks that also need to exist within that space. And I think they're complementary to the people that do the programming and developing, and I'll say the technical skills that are there.
I agree with that 100%. That's a lot of the reasons why when I do interview, like even for jobs, one of the ways I'm able to get offers or go work whatever different companies is the fact that I understand that my job supports the business processes. And I also understand my audience and how to talk to regular people. I think that's an underrated skill. When you were talking about that business people actually do need to be in tech, because those are the people that know how to drive home the points that that developer, that coder sometimes doesn't. They get caught up in like what they're doing and they're siloed. And they don't know how to convey that over to the stakeholders, but you do. And that's a skill that everyone doesn't have. And I tend to tell people that it's needed. Yeah. It's definitely needed.
Yeah, yes, it is, man. And I think that I actually think it's hard to find. I think that at times it may not be given the credit that it deserves. And I'm sure that's the case for many roles at an organization. You know, I can only speak about this one because it's the one that I'm working on. But I think, you know, to have someone to look out and protect the sanity of the technical team and not put on them more than they can bear, and to be understanding of that. And then also to look out for the client and also to look out for the company's bottom line and to be able to like have a narrative where everyone gets it. Right, to be able to translate for all of those different stakeholders. It's not necessarily an easy thing. And I think the people that do get it, like you're saying, they tend to be very successful in the role.
Yep. So once you leave from being the C-level, and I want to make sure I didn't butcher it, Chief Operations Officer, correct? Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm right.
That's
okay.
Correct.
I want to make sure, because I was going to say chief business operations and I was like, that's not it. So after you leave there, is that when you do? Well, let me back up because I did go through your bio. Were you already doing angel investing then while you were the chief operation officer?
I was, yeah. The idea was that as my earnings and income increased, and I had more than what would cover like my lifestyle, I started thinking about how did I want to invest and what did I want to do with those earnings. And so I, you know, different people put their money in the stock market, different people buy homes and do real estate. I put my money and I chose to put my money into companies and invest in companies. And so for me, it was like very rewarding, but that's the idea of an angel investor. It's folks that take their capital and they look to invest in and support entrepreneurs and people that are building small businesses.
Thank you. I'm glad you explained that. That way I didn't have to ask it. The next question, when it comes to an angel investor, do you have to have a certain amount of money to be deemed an angel investor, or can you be an angel investor at any part of your career with whatever money you have?
Yeah, I would empower folks to know that you can be an angel investor at any level. You know, Barack Obama created legislation that allowed for crowdfunding to companies. And like as a result, you know, you can go on a Startup Engine, or you can go on Republic, or you can go on like these different platforms like Indiegogo, and you can invest $100 in the company, $1,000 in the company, $10,000 in the company. And so I appreciate a lot of the work that President Obama did while he was in office, with this being an example. And a lot of folks, I don't know if they sort of understand or give him credit for the fact that it was a very close, tight-knit, there were a lot of regulations around what angel investing looked like prior to him and his legislation. Now, with that being said, angel investing, when it comes to a private citizen to a private company, there are some, I'll say, requirements and criteria around it legally. And so I think it's a pretty big barrier of entry. Like, you either have to have $1 million in assets to be an accredited investor, according to the U.S. government, or you have to make over $350,000 for 3 consecutive years. Companies that are raising funds, you'll hear about a company raising like their Series A or something like that. When you hear of individuals that are investors in those raises, those individuals meet that criteria. And it's on the legal counsel of the companies that's doing the fundraising to make sure those investors meet that criteria. So historically speaking, and I think still it's the case for private companies, but for crowdfunding, anyone can be an angel investor.
Cool. And I was actually going to ask you about that, because I've always seen that, like, especially in tech, you see all these different startups and we got this amount of funding. And maybe this could be a game you could put my listeners on, because I'm not as well versed into that portion of when it comes to startups or when they're trying to go public and all that. If a person was looking into a job at a company and they were talking about whatever series funding they had, for you, if you were going to work there as just a regular employee, and, you know, in hopes that either the company makes it through and they go public, or you can be okay with worrying about, like, is the company going to exist tomorrow? What should they look for?
I think what you should look for. So typically, you know, a lot of this has a framework. And so when a company's raising what's called their pre-seed, that funding is typically good for 6 months to a year. When a company's raising their seed round and they close it, that money is typically good for 1 to 2 years. When a company's raising their Series A, it's typically good for 3 to 5 years, as an example. And so these are like well-known sort of parameters of fundraising among the investor community, right? And so and the number that they raise is typically how much they need for that time frame. right? And so that's why different companies in different spaces have different fundraising amounts for pre-seed, seed, and Series A. And so I think as long as a company can successfully raise and close their Series A, and as long as you feel like the founding team of that company is like smart and prudent with that money, then I say go for it. You should go to work with them. And, you know, there are some folks that, you know, raise money and like they own yachts and boats and different things like that. And in my opinion, that would be a telltale sign that like, hey, are they going to have enough money for this entire time frame, or are they going to come up short and need to raise again? I think oftentimes that's done unknown to the employee and unknown to the staff, right? It's known to the board and it's known to the investors, but it's not known to the staff. And so, you know, I think a smart entrepreneur would sort of try to keep that away from team members. But I do think that if you're going to interview somewhere, you should ask the hiring folks, you know, how are they going about spending money? Like what is their practices around it? And I think that'll give you some insight. And so on the surface, that may sound fun and look fun if they're doing like a lot of extravagant or what may be think that's cool stuff as a startup. But you should know in the back of your head, that means they're going to have to raise more capital from someone else. And that could jeopardize your job security.
Appreciate that insight. And speaking of money and capital, I wanted to segue into this question. It was supposed to be an icebreaker, and it's been a couple of weeks since the news broke about Silicon Valley Bank. But I want to get your thoughts on it, because I'm pretty sure you was following some of this and had your own take on like what happened with Silicon Valley Bank.
Yeah. I mean, so I had little to no impact to me personally and the companies that we invest in with Silicon Valley Bank. And I feel fortunate in that regard. That aside, like my thoughts on the collapse of it, I think that we should all be mindful and pay attention to the effects that that bank collapse can have on regional and community banks. And it can and should be concerning, especially for those in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. So as an example, Silicon Valley Bank was really good at giving home mortgages to entrepreneurs. For anyone that's an entrepreneur, they know that like it's very, very difficult for you to buy a home on your own. And like what you have to go through compared to someone that has a W-2 and that's employed by someone else, like it's just crazy. And a place like Silicon Valley Bank understood that, and they catered to those that are startup founders or those employees that are like the first 10 employees that work for a startup. They were able to do underwriting in a way where it was more friendly to those folks. And for the record, that business that they had was a sound, good business. It had nothing to do with like their collapse and why they went under. And so what I'm getting at is, you know, places like a Wells Fargo or, you know, larger banks, like they're not going to be friendly to entrepreneurs and people in this ecosystem that's looking to get a home loan or a car loan. Like they have their traditional metrics, and what they look for is what they look for. And so when you have companies like SVB collapsing, I believe that it will have a ripple effect in ways like that. Another example is lines of credit. You know, to a great degree, a line of credit is really what a business needs. And if, you know, an entrepreneur were to go to some of our larger banks, you know, they may get a line of credit for $200,000 or $300,000, but at a place like SVB, they had a larger line of credit, and it's because SVB had experts that understood the industry, that understood the vertical, that could properly sort of give you a line of credit that would be helpful. And again, that had nothing to do with their collapse. That line of business was pretty solid for them. And so I can see like ripple effects that will happen in the market as a result of SVB collapse. And right now, you know, we have situations where interest rates are so high that a lot of people aren't really trying to buy a house right now. So it's not a conversation, but, you know, let's give it a year or two when the rates come down and folks are looking to move more and purchase homes more. I think you should check on your friends and entrepreneurs, because I think it's going to be very difficult for them to be able to enjoy in those like traditional things that we value as Americans that is easier to get for other people. So yeah, we should keep our eye on that. And I believe there'll be ripple effects of it.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I think there's also been a push for a lot of people who are entrepreneurs to also have them like a highly skilled job that lets them have like flexibility to run their businesses for like, I would believe situations like this, as well as like you said, maybe easier to get a home and do other things until they can either scale their business the correct way or just have it to fall back on.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I understand that sentiment.
Okay, so I've already asked you about angel investing. Now let's get into High Street Equity and how that came about. It was just a meeting of the minds to say, hey, man, we need to do this for the culture. How did that come about? Because even the name's interesting, right?
Yeah. So my business partner, Tristan, and I have known one another for 12 years. And when I became a partner and executive at the tech firm that I was at, and I started to invest in like the startup thing and small businesses. Tristan left, he was working on Capitol Hill. He left Capitol Hill. And like many people do that leave Capitol Hill, he started his own public affairs firm. And after a few years and that public affairs firm was doing well, he came to me and was like, hey man, I got a little cash. It would be nice to, I heard you've been investing. It would be nice to co-invest with you. And if you could share some of the deals you're seeing across your desk. And so I started to share deals. We started to co-invest together. And that's what led us down this journey. And you know, the idea is that I believe that to a great degree, running a business is like being in a marriage. And similarly, I think it's smart for people to do deals together and smaller deals to get to know one another and build up to a larger business partnership and relationship. And that's what Tristan and I did. And so after co-investing together for 6 or 7 years, we started to have conversations around like, this is great. We're making money. You know, it's mainly our money. Like, what would it look like if we were to sort of 10x this or 100x this? And what would it look like if we were to have, you know, institutional investors back us and support us and take this to the next level? And so that's how this conversation around High Street Equity Partners formed and came about. And so it really was like a natural organic evolution for us. And for me, it was like I was becoming much more interested in this than what I was doing in other things, you know? And so it was this sort of gradual, organic growth in this area. And the name, like you asked about the name, man, we were brainstorming and talking one day, and we were talking about like what we wanted the firm to stand for and symbolize, and you know, everything you do when you're coming up with like what you want to name something. And Tristan shared with me in that conversation that his family grew up off of a street in Arkansas that very similar to the Tulsa Street in Oklahoma and everything around Black Wall. I said Tulsa Street. I'm sorry, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Black Wall Street in the Greenwood District in Oklahoma. His family had connectivity to the Arkansas version of that, and he was telling me about the businesses they had, you know, over 60, 70 years ago, and sort of what that was like. And, you know, it was the perfect connectivity and narrative to what we're trying to do in this 21st century economy. And so Tristan had like a version and an iteration of this with High Street already that he conceptualized. And so when he told me that narrative, and like, it just made a lot of sense. And so we were like, this is what it needs to be. So let's build that out.
Man, that's dope, man. I thought about, like, it's funny because even though, like, my show is The Textual Talk, people don't know, like, how many other things I like to talk about. And that's why I always try to go talk other places, like when you start bringing up Black Wall Street. And I started immediately thinking about how I didn't really learn about Black Wall Street until I was, like, an adult. And one of the reasons as a whole, like, you have people that are outliers, but as a whole, that hasn't been as good for us as it could, is because of, I believe it starts when we're kids and how we're educated and how we're not taught, you know, the full history. And since this is my podcast, I'm going to say it. And when I say the full history, I'm talking about that the fact that they're not showing the other people that we're the ones that actually educated them. And so I feel like if they go back to even that and kind of show, hey, this is what it really was like, I think it'd be much respect for everybody. And people would be able to work. I think we'll look at working with each other a little bit more better. Because, for example, as a kid, you really don't realize it. But when you talk about, oh, Jackie Robinson, blah, 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 and all these other things, that kind of conditioned you that the other leagues was better than what we had, right? However, they really were competition. And they really stopped the bleeding by taking them from that and then destroying businesses that these were, you know, sporting leagues, hospitals, lawyers, schools, all the same stuff that, you know, we could have thought on our own with. But this is not a history podcast, but it's just a little food for thought for people to understand that if you kind of go back and relearn what you learned, you will realize you were duped in some ways to maybe not realize, hey, no, these things were successful businesses. It's not like they were just bad things. They paint them in the picture like they were so bad. Sure, you had some issues in education sectors where the school might not have been the best, but that wasn't like that for everybody. I think it's just like it is now. You, by zip codes, you have some great school districts and some bad school districts.
Wow. I am a student of history, and I read about history a lot, man. And, you know, it's funny, when I was growing up in school, I didn't care to read about much of anything. I just wanted to get good grades and hang out, but reading wasn't my thing. And as an adult, that's definitely changed and evolved for me. And so in recent years, you know, I'd say the last 10 years, like, I've just been reading a lot of books by Coates and around a lot of other authors around the history of like The Color of Law and the history of housing and redlining, around The Color of Money and the history around places like Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the business world. And, you know, I think to your point, it's wild to me that there's an attempt to not have us celebrate history of all people and their contributions in the country and around the world. To be honest with you, I will see it on TV or on the news, and I'll shake my head and be like, that's wild, that's not cool. I think that I would have an even deeper and more profound response to it if I had kids. And if I was, you know, I don't have any kids as of yet. But I think to have kids and to have to live with this and to have to talk to your kids at home, but have to deal with the schools and like these topics and your kids' school, I think it would hit home even deeper for folks. Like, it's a very concerning and troubling thing when we think about it. And it's not just concerning that your kids are being denied an opportunity to learn about their history. I think what's really important also is that there need to be other people that know about your historical contributions, and they need to appreciate that and value that. So we're going to have kids 40 years from now that's disagreeing with people in the workplace or out and about and be like, that's not true. Like, you didn't do that, or your people didn't do that. And, you know, they're going to be speaking from a place where they feel like it's true because they've been denied this. I think that is the most troubling thing to me as I look down the road and think about the future and like how that can play out. And so I don't know the answer to it, bro. I really don't. But I agree that it's troubling. And I think that when I have kids, I'm going to have to figure that out. I think that's what the idea of organizations like Jack and Jill and the Links and some of these other like historical African-American led organizations. It was like our kids will not get this in the spaces where they're going to school and operating. So we have to make sure they get it outside of the classroom.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see sort of how those things evolve and take shape, like organizations like that. But I do think that other people not learning about your history is not.
Yeah, good. Definitely. And I just agree with you. Like I went through like I don't like the term woke because it's used for stupid movements, but an awakening when I moved out here about 7 years ago and I started reading books and I started getting a little furious about just things that I didn't know, because it is upsetting. Like, you go your whole life kind of thinking one thing, you find out these other things, right? But, you know, maybe that's some Patreon info. Maybe my subscribers, they want to check out like some of the books or some of the things that I looked into years ago. We could talk about that. But to piggyback on what you were talking about, but you and your business partner, and you're saying how you really were getting that feel for actually wanting to go all the way through with High Street Equity, I definitely understand how you feel, because that's how I've been feeling the last 3 years with doing content and also like doing my coaching stuff. It's like, even though I'm good at what I do in my professional job, I feel like I was made to do what I do now. Like, literally, if I didn't have any responsibilities, any kids, anything like that, I probably could podcast and talk and teach people probably every day.
I
made a tweet about this a couple of months ago. I said, it's funny, I got in trouble a lot in school for talking a lot, mainly because work wasn't challenging enough. So I used to get in trouble for things like that. But I was like, it's funny how I got in trouble for talking a lot. But now this is what I do on a regular. And I'm made for it, just for the fact that it's not a chore to me. And I work on getting better at this craft every day. And so I definitely just feel you on that point. It's like, you know what? I really like this. How do I, you know, transition and turn this into a living, you know, for me and my family, or, you know, that, and then you just break it down and it starts coming to maybe other business ventures you can do and help people out. And it's one of the things where, you know, now, if we look at how people are scared of change, right? It used to be, oh, go to the radio and pay them X amount of money so they can run ads on your stuff. Instead of that, you don't need the radio anymore. You can go find a popular podcaster or a YouTuber that's in the niche that you're in that they could literally probably talk about exactly what you talk about and say, hey, I'll give you $2,000 for 5 episodes. Well, $10,000 for 5 episodes to run this ad for me or whatever. And these people probably could have so many followers, but it's just one of the ways where people can help each other. And
that's,
you can, you know, somebody said, oh, why would you give somebody $10,000? Because the $10,000 made me $100,000, made me $500,000. You know, it's just one of those things where now that's kind of where the trend is. Like, because unlike radio, the people that tune into these podcasts have built a connection with the host. And
that's
so
right.
Things that I co-sign now, and I'm careful now, whatever I want to sponsor or who reaches out to me, I research it. And if I like it, then I'll promote it. And the people that listen to me or my clients, they know I'm blunt when it comes to telling you if I like something, if I don't like it. And I keep it very honest with you, especially when it comes to getting jobs or being in tech, because I don't want to trick people. They're going to be that guy of, I just went and bought, you know, a Lambo and telling you I did this, getting in tech, and you go do it too, you know. No experience, come get, you know, six figures. I'll never do that to my people, because the people that don't really know how it goes are willing to sell their souls to get this money, and then afterwards are so upset because they've been had. And I'm going to do a separate series on these things as I really start getting my Inspector Gadget on, when I actually just start dissecting some of these programs out here that I feel like are abusing people's ignorance.
Yeah, yeah. You know, connected to what you're saying, I have a investment thesis, as we call it, around this topic, and that is we invest in what we call future of work. And the idea behind it is we believe that how work will look over the next 20 years will be dramatically different than what it looked like over the last 20 years and definitely the last 50 years. And it's one of the verticals or spaces, as we call it, that we look to invest in. And I believe that I'm a millennial, and I believe that this millennial and Gen Z demographic just views work very differently
totally
than what
agree.
Our older brothers and sisters or parents view work. And I see this like idea and concept of how we have the gig economy and how just a lot of folks within that particular demographic, like, we're passionate about multiple things. Like, it's really hard for us just to want to do and focus on one thing. And, you know, over time, we sort of find what we're very, very passionate about, how you were just talking about with podcasts and with communications. And the idea is, like, how can you do that and focus on that and what this creator economy looks like and it supports your family? And so, you know, I won't sort of drill deeply down into that, but like at a macro level, at a top line level, we feel passionate that work will look differently over the next 20 years. And so we're looking to invest in companies and entrepreneurs that have companies and products and solutions like centered around that.
I totally agree. And that's why I've been learning more about, well, you know, every other day, there's some different AI product that's coming out. And some people are scared of it instead of just embracing, you know, how AI and automation can actually probably help you make more money as well and do less work. Because that's what a lot of people do now. They use the ChatGPT to, you know, formulate these emails and these sales things, and they schedule them out and they send out and they are making a living by, I mean, unfortunately, it's like this, but replacing people that could have did it for them. That's one of the issues too that I've seen. So I'm a person that's, I love technology, but I also do not like when it replaces the human element of certain things. Like we talk about the service industry or we talk about retail. I'm not a fan of all the self-checkout. I'm not a fan of having to spend my money where prices are going up and check my stuff out versus letting the cashier do it.
I think that those things will create different jobs. It's my belief. It's my hypothesis, I'll say. I do believe that as automation comes into play, we're going to see upskilling and reskilling happen, and people are going to shift to different spaces. And so there may be industries or sectors that are net losers, as in like, less jobs are created, but I do think that those humans and the people will shift to different sectors based on like their interests. And you know, I'm a strong believer in that. And so the idea for us, right, is, and I'm sort of oversimplifying it, but within this future of work umbrella, you have what we would call sort of remote work and automations. and like investing in the companies that are solving that for the next 20 years. And then on the other side, what I would call like blue collar industry, we will have upskilling and reskilling and the companies and the technologies that's solving for that. And I think that overall, like everyone will be a winner. I really do believe that. And we're looking to invest in the space to make sure that's the case, right? And it's our belief that, you know, it's people within this millennial and Gen Z demographic that are in a position to be investors. We're the best people to sort of be able to invest in these companies because we are living it and breathing it, right? Like our friends are living it and breathing it. And so we're pretty close to being on the ground as well as we're in a position to invest and support them. And I think that's what sort of makes us special and different as opposed to someone at 60 or 70 years old looking to invest right. in the space. They don't have as much connectivity to it as we do.
I agree. And I definitely feel like that's the reason why people our age should be running the country. Because it is a lot of things where people are out of touch with. Like we just talked about that silly mess that we saw a couple of weeks ago with the Congress talking to the owner of TikTok or the CEO of TikTok. It was totally stupid. But I think another reason why millennials and Gen Z, though there are differences between us and Gen Z, I feel like, you know, I feel like Gen Z is softer than we are. I think those are just the facts. But I'll say millennials are the best, and it's me being biased, but we're probably the last bit of people that remembers things before it was just straight internet everything, you know, cassette tapes, CD players, Blockbuster, TV guide, you having to go to your friend's house to play the video game, like other, you know, other things that were there, you know, actually going to, well, they have movies and malls now, but it was a little bit different back then. But we've also been the people that have had to adapt to probably the most change maybe in our lifetime. So I feel like we are the best to always not be so stubborn, because that's what's happened with the people that are older than us. They came up one way, or I just want to do it like this. They don't want to learn anything new. We've constantly had to learn new things in order even just to find jobs. And a lot of us are still fairly young. So I totally agree with you on that point. I think that is great insight on how to really perceive what you think may be happening, because that's how I think of it too. Like how you call it the future of work. I think of it too. Like I have to start about like the future internet of things when you've got smart cities. So other tech companies you can invest in that ideally will make it easier for things to be a little bit more interconnected in cities. So those are definitely things that are coming about. I think, like you said, everything is changing within, I'll say, probably the next 15 years. It's going to be a lot of different stuff that people should be just kind of looking into now. Like we already got a lot of the autonomous vehicles. Just imagine when you get a little bit more of the smart tech in the cities, robots. It just be a lot of different things, but I want to ask you some other stuff. And honestly, like this conversation has like gotten so good. I'm like, we might have to just break this one up for like in two parts, to be quite honest.
I love that. I love that.
I want to quickly ask you about this. And I'm asking you about this question about the women and indigenous and people of color getting funding. Probably been the least amount of people that get funding. And I want to ask you about this because I remember I have a connection, a friend of mine. I don't know what's going on with his company right now, but he was always talking about how hard it was for him being like the black man, the face of the company, getting this funding, having these different meetings and getting the funding that he needed for his solution and his product that he knows is a good product. And that's also what made me think about that. Like as I was reading, I said, you know what? I've seen people have companies have software products that are great, but they're having issues getting funding based on the hue of their skin.
Yeah. There are structural and systemic issues with getting people funding that are folks of color, and that's across the board. That's in when you're trying to go to the bank and get a loan for your business or a loan for even your home, when you're looking to go to venture capital and get funding for your business that way. And so I think more people like High Street Equity Partners being in the space, the better things will become. And there are allies in the spaces, I call them as well. And so it's not totally dependent upon BIPOC fund managers to do that. But yeah, in short, there are structural issues that are in place, and it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. And so if the question is sort of, why do I think that is? I think that people tend to invest in people that remind them of their sons and daughters. And I think it's easier for folks to invest in people that remind them of their sons and daughters. And so inherently, that's what you see playing out. And to share with your listeners, 98% of the venture capitalists and the industry is non-diverse. And to share with your listeners, as a result, we see that playing out because only 2% of diverse people that have companies get funding. Only 3% of women that have women-led companies get funding. And when you add the two of those together, with Black women in particular, they get 0.1% of all venture capital dollars. And so it's unfortunate thing, but we're changing that, right? So 0.1% of the industry, 0.1% of dollars go to Black women, and 66% of our portfolio right now has been investing in Black women in particular, right, as a company. And so we are intentionally looking to invest in those spaces that have been overlooked. And the reality is that it's not necessarily charitable work, right? Like, it's good business. Like, Black women are creating companies that are record high. They're becoming one of the most well-educated cohorts ever at a record high. Like, they're handling business, and they have very, very good companies. But why they can't get funding for those companies when they go to speak with investors is really unknown to us. And so for those that are great, we're investing in them and we're supporting them. And for those that are on their way and on along in the journey, but they're early, we're still trying to point them in the right direction and make sure they have the resources and the advisors that they need in order to grow, to be at a place where people like us can invest in them financially.
I totally agree. And I feel like that, goes around all around the board. And that's why a lot of people, like whenever I reach out to them about getting on the show, or especially when it comes to women, or even if they want to be clients, I think one of the first things they start seeing is like, oh, he's had like a lot of women on here, especially Black women. And I was like, yeah, because y'all are, I think I did this article about diversity in cybersecurity, and I want to say African Americans were like 8 or 7%, and Black women made up even less than that. So when I started this thing, when it just came to tech jobs in general, that's who I highlighted the most. I was like, most little girls or even just women that they're their age now aren't going to see this on a day to day wherever they're working at. So I was like, let me show everybody, hey, you guys can do this too. And, reach out to these women if you want to do what they do. So I definitely agree with that. Yeah. Like, it's like, it's some barriers in place that everyone, I think, can do their part to help out with these things. Amongst also, starting our own companies, because, and this will be like some of the ending parts of part one, because if not, this thing will go on to like probably 3 o'clock your time. But I think it is time for us to start more businesses in some of these services areas that we already work in. Because if the truth be told, a lot of the companies we work for, a lot of people don't know what they're doing. Sometimes they just surviving off of name recognition alone. But if you were actually in some in these meetings or looking at some of the financials, like a lot of stuff don't make sense. But the key is, though, is that, like you said, once you do start your own thing, how do you actually get the business? Are they going to keep you out purposely? Like we see in other arenas, like we go something small, it's like NFL, like, you know, of course, cool. Yeah, the Waltons bought the Broncos, but hey, let's do one or two things. I know Larry Allen, I think that's his name, wanted to buy the Broncos. Well, if you don't want them to learn about the Broncos, how about not let's make two more NFL teams, right? Let those be minority owners. You know, there are ways to do this. They're making it harder than it has to be. But anything you want to leave the listeners with, man, I'm telling you guys now, we are going to do a part two. I don't know when. The next one will be a video or, you know, who knows? Maybe I find a way to go to D.C. or something and do something live. Who knows?
That would be dope.
But I definitely enjoyed it. I knew I would from when the first time we talked in the car. It's like we talked for about an hour then. So I was like, yeah, this thing is going to be good. And the fact that, like I told you, you know, for the listeners, I try to have questions I come up with kind of just to give the people I'm going to talk to a feel of the things that I'll ask. But I tell them most of the time, those are kind of like guidelines. And I'm typically just going to listen to what you say and ask a question from that versus trying to just ask that. Cause I tend to get better questions out that way, especially if you say something that really resonated with me. Cause I don't really, sometimes, especially with this being something different, I didn't know where I wanted to go with it. So I said, I'm going to get a basis, go with the flow, and then we'll definitely just get into like some great questions that, you know, should help our listeners out.
You know, I like the go with the flow approach because it also allows you to get things out that you feel passionate about that in the normal interview or discussion on a platform like this, you don't get a chance to, right? And so the reality is, yes, I have thoughts and strong thoughts on what's going on around how folks are looking to educate our kids and like the different topics that we covered. And I actually think that those someone's from a functional area, whether it be venture capital or cybersecurity or the likes, like they can have a really good take on a position that makes other people want to think about it and makes other people want to look into it or research more on it. And so I appreciate your approach to it, bro. I do.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I just like to always have that organic feel of the show. Like it's got better structurally, but it helps me. Like if I need something to ask right there, I can go look at it to just maybe go segue into something else. Maybe I feel like the people want to know, but for the most part, just getting that authentic stuff. Because a lot of times you never know. Someone is thinking what you're thinking, but they may not want to say it. That's been my moniker. It's like, you said what I want to say. I'm built to take the hate whenever somebody feels like something I say they don't like. Cool. You know, lower your voice and just strengthen your argument. That's all I ask. Because you cannot beat the person with the mic. Never. You never win against the person with the mic. But guys, man, it's been another episode. Appreciate you guys for tuning in. And like I always say, let's stay textual. And we are out.